Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Joe Biden raids the Treasury again. Alabama's effort to protect in vitro embryos and the GOP's unity, or lack thereof. I'm Noah Rothman. Rich is out today, but in his absence, we're joined by Charles C.W. Cook, MBD Michael Brendan Doherty, and Madeline Maddie Kearns. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Donors Trust and the Competitive Enterprise Institute. More on them later on. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere, from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So this week, Joe Biden announced another round of what he calls student loan forgiveness, what his Republican critics rightly denounce as not forgiveness, but transference of that debt onto the backs of taxpayers. All of $1.2 billion in this round, bringing the grand total of so-called student loan forgiveness to $138 billion. The president has tried to tailor these attempts in his efforts to raid the Treasury in support of his constituents with degrees to comport with the Supreme Court decision in Biden v. Nebraska, but Biden doesn't want you to know that. He said, quote, "The Supreme Court blocked it, but that didn't stop me." Charlie, he wants you to think he's being lawless. Why should we not oblige him?
Well, it depends what you mean. We should oblige him in the sense that we should point out that he wants us to believe that he's defying the law, which is bad in and of itself. And also that even if these orders are legal, and there's some problems with the arguments in their favor, although I wonder whether a court would strike them down, this is not how the American system is supposed to work. The latest round is being executed under what the Biden administration has called the SAVE plan, S-A-V-E. This is not a straightforward application of the statute that is being invoked in its defense. This is an application of the administrative changes that the Biden White House has made, and an early one at that. These changes are supposed to go into effect in July of this year. They've already been used and touted. Those changes are quite dramatic. They lower the time that one has to wait before one can get so-called relief. They changed the income thresholds. They changed the way that $0 payments are regarded. This is quite a complicated administrative law question, and I've read arguments on both sides as to their legality. But we should not buy the argument that's being made in some quarters that, unlike what Biden was doing with his plan that was struck down by the Supreme Court, this is just American law. It's American law as filtered through substantial changes that the Biden administration has made to it that is controversial. So what he is doing here is changing or altering the law, whether legally or not, in order to spend hundreds of billions of dollars. And even if you think that this is technically legal, I'm skeptical, but I'm open to the argument. This isn't how America is supposed to work. Once again, we are looking at a president who is making real changes to the law and extracting enormous amounts of taxpayers' money from the Treasury in order to achieve an agenda item that he can't get through Congress. The total amount that this is supposed to cost over 10 years is $475 billion. That is a $500 billion purchase. That's net. In other words, because Joe Biden has made these changes, the United States is going to spend $500 trillion more than it would have had the law that Congress passed been interpreted in the way that it was before Joe Biden became president. So before we get onto the policy of this, there is a big problem here in my estimation in that Biden has changed the way the law is being executed at enormous cost because Congress won't do it. And that's just not how the American system is set up.
So before we move on, Charlie, you wrote in your piece, Biden's student loan lawlessness must not go unanswered. Everybody should go read it. You insist on that Republicans, in a very passionate piece, which everybody should go read, that Republicans must seek a remedy for this, for the taxpayers who've been fleeced. If Republicans don't push back hard for restitution in the form of changes to tax law, for example, to, quote, give back the money to the people who were given a free ride, Republicans would be guilty of an unforgivable abdication.
Yeah. Look, the argument that is being made by Joe Biden here is wholly dishonest. Forget the law for a moment. Politically, it is dishonest. He makes it seem as if he is engaged in reform. But he's not. He's transferring money from people who did not take out loans to pay for a college education that they received and benefited from, and giving it to the people who did take out loans to pay for a college education that they received and benefited from. Nothing has changed within the college system. He hasn't even pushed for changes. He hasn't got a bill that he's asked Congress to pass. Higher education is working exactly as it did before. There's no alterations to that funding mechanism. There's no shift in the price of college or its costs or its staff or its overheads. There's no change to credentialized institutions. It is not a reform. And because of that, it's very difficult to see as anything other than playing winners and losers for politics. And my point is that given that this is not part of some larger reform process, and given that it is not the sort of action that we would normally regard as being ameliorative, that is to say, irrespective of whether or not we like it or agree with it, an attempt to take all people who are in a particular situation, whether they're poor or starving or disabled, and give them a minimum standard of living, then it's outrageous for Biden to ask every taxpayer to pick this up. And I want to know what Republicans are going to do to make sure that the people from whom this money has been taken don't end up paying for it. Of course, they will in the short term. But once Biden's gone, what are Republicans going to do in the next budget? Are they going to tax the people who received this largesse? Are they going to give a tax break to the people who didn't? Are they going to tax or raid, frankly, the university's endowments? Are they going to make it more difficult for philanthropists to write money off their tax bill by giving $5 billion to Harvard? I think that is an absolutely legitimate and necessary question. What are Republicans going to do to make sure that the waitress or the carpenter or the small business owner is not actually on the hook for this transfer of liability? If Biden can do this, so can the Republicans, and they should.
Madeline, the New York Times on this maneuver noted with some palpable bitterness that Biden's, quote, piecemeal efforts have garnered him little praise. Poor fella. So that's in part because the outcomes that his rapacious constituents want is out of bounds. It's flatly illegal, and his attempts to mollify them have been essentially gimmicks. This latest one is a gimmick. It applies to roughly 150,000 borrowers who took out less than $12,000 in loans and have been paying them out for 10 years or more. It's a very narrow set of criteria that apply to those who would receive this forgiveness. Nevertheless, the design here is to buy off voters. It's in the email that you're going to get. Congratulations. The email that you're going to get from Joe Biden will read, all or a portion of your federal student loans have been forgiven because you qualify for early loan forgiveness under my administration's SAVE plan. This seems like a lot of political risk to court for almost no realizable benefit.
Yeah, I don't quite understand his calculus here, because as you say, those who stand to benefit are a narrow group. As Charlie pointed out as well, They're overwhelmingly middle class, obviously college educated. These people tend to vote Democrat anyway. I'm not really sure what advantage there is for Biden. And, you know, as you mentioned, he's essentially buying votes. What other possible explanation could we have for this? But he's buying votes with the taxpayers' money. And at a time where, you know, people are very sensitive about Biden's handling of the economy. So I think that the political risks are significant, as Charlie mentions. It doesn't address the problems, the very real problems with higher education generally. He's not going to change the way it works. He's not going to alter the funding mechanisms for anyone other than these debtors. He's not going to reduce the cost of college. So what is the point of this, other than angering people, rightly, and clearly trying to shore up his political base in an election year? That doesn't seem like it's likely to work.
Michael, I've said here and I've written previously that I think Donald Trump is going to have a really hard time trying to retake the presidency, regardless of what the polls say today. But I've also written that if I'm wrong, I'm wrong for wholly knowable reasons. The foremost among them being that Democrats are leaning really, really heavily into this new conceptualization of their coalition as one ballasted by degree holders. And there just aren't enough of them. Roughly 38% of Americans have college degrees or more. And as a result, the Democratic Party is hemorrhaging support across all demographics, but the common thread across them is that people without degrees, rather, are fleeing the party's ranks. This is just terrible political math, and they seem wholly committed to it.
Yeah, it speaks to a cultural bubble that a lot of people live in. They talk about politics and conceive of politics as something, you know, that they do on Twitter, online, with, you know, the chattering class, in dialogue with media figures, et cetera, all of whom, you know, or almost all of whom have college degrees. But the fact is, like, the Democratic Party relies also on, you know, to coin a phrase, a multiracial working class, right? I mean, it relies on Black and brown voters who, you know, work in all sorts of industries where they use their hands and they don't have degrees. Now there are some people who need want student debt relief who never achieved a degree, and but in fact that's actually what makes this policy so egregious in a way, is that the way we treat student loans in this country and hand them out actually incentivizes the creation of an entire layer of colleges that serves working class people by preying upon them. Literally, like, offering them, you know, offering to load them up with debt when they work in five-figure service jobs. The graduation rates are usually, you know, well below 30% over 6 years, completion rates. And then the people return to the service jobs with no extra earnings that they were, you know, promised when they were told they were going to better themselves studying. But a whole college exists with six-figure salaries for administrators and mediocre professors. So it's like there's an element of, like, you know, if you were a Marxist, I think you would be really vicious about the predatory nature of the Democrat educated class and its predation upon people, and the way it's soaking them.
Yeah, but if you're a practicing Marxist, you have a degree yourself.
That's, again, you know, we need older school uneducated Marxists for this job. But no, I you know, this is I think you're right, and a mistake of innumeracy on the Democratic Party's part. But again, this is such a politically active and loud part of the party that has a megaphone to shout in. I mean, we've seen since 2014, Obama introduced a very modest change to 529 college savings plans that would, you know, favor the upper middle class a little bit less in the way they save for their children's college tuition than before. And he was like politically nuked for it, like in a few weeks, it just disappeared. So, you know, the college is like a sacred element of the Democratic identity, and they will, I think they are willing to pay a political price for that fact.
Quick exit question for everybody. Charlie, starting with you, on Wednesday, November 6, 2024, Democrats will regret these efforts to mollify the avarice of the degree holders in their ranks. Yes or no?
I don't know. It's very hard to answer that question when Donald Trump is the nominee. What I do know is that if what Joe Biden has done here becomes part of a coherent case against him that holds that while he talks a good game about being Joe from Scranton, his presidency has actually been bad for the people he says he's helping and good for those he pretends to villainize, then yes, it will. Because the people that we're talking about here, the people who are receiving these bailouts, are already doing better than everyone else. They have better health outcomes. They have better employment prospects. They make more money. They're more likely to own a home. Their divorce rate is lower. These are not the people in America who are downtrodden. The same problem obtains when it comes to the inflation that Biden made worse. Didn't cause, but made worse. The average upper middle class person who owned a house prior to Biden's presidency is doing all right. There are a lot of people who are not. And if Trump, and I don't believe this for a moment because he's so ill-disciplined, but if Trump can make that case and weave this college obsession into it, then yes, Biden will come to regret it.
Madeline.
Sorry, Noah, could you repeat the framing of the question?
Will they regret it the day after the election that all the efforts to bribe their degree holders and their ranks to put their misgivings with Biden aside?
Yes, yeah, I think they will, but I think they will have much greater cause for regret in proceeding with Biden as the nominee.
Michael.
No, I don't think they will. I agree with you, Noah. I think the Democrats are likely to have a better than expected election night this November, and I believe they will credit female suburbanites who want their children to go to college, who maybe have some college or completed college themselves, and for whom issues like this are just, you know, an affirmation of their identity and their importance in the political coalition. And so I think this will work.
I agree with Michael. I don't think they're going to regret it on election day. I do think they're going to regret it in the long term as they sacrifice the last remnants of the New Deal coalition. But what this demonstrates is obviously you don't want to trust your money to Joe Biden. But you know who you do want to trust your money to? Donors Trust. In times of crisis, those with a giving spirit and a desire to build up a civil society find ways to be helpful. And that's when it's good to have charitable resources ready to deploy when they're needed most. Donors Trust offers donor-advised funds and giving accounts. You can use those funds as your own charitable investment account and manage your charitable giving in a way that's smart, tax-advantaged, and private. Donors Trust clients are using their funds to support charities in their local communities and think tanks, preserving civil liberties, among other things. Now is the time to take a closer look at Donors Trust and join their community of liberty-minded donors by opening a donor-advised fund. Go to donorstrust.org/editors for our The Ultimate Survival Guide to Charitable Giving, and learn how a donor-advised fund can preserve your ability to give charitably. That's donorstrust.org/editors. So, Madeline, the Alabama Supreme Court ruled this week that frozen embryos should be considered children with all requisite legal protections. Specifically, this ruling covers these embryos under that state's, Alabama's, Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, which lets parents sue for damages following the death of a child. The case was brought by several couples whose embryos were destroyed after a patient removed them from a tank of liquid nitrogen and dropped them on the floor accidentally, I would imagine, thereby creating this damage and opening up this lawsuit. The law in Alabama already protects unborn children, and it no longer makes any exception for extra uterine children. What do you make of this decision?
Yeah, so I think the case itself, so the plaintiffs are very sympathetic. These are obviously the embryo's parents, and they, I have no doubt, had a sense of profound and very real loss at the destruction of these embryos, their children, and all the hopes and dreams that they hope to see fulfilled in them. Obviously, the place that was storing the embryos had let them down in a very serious way. But the question that comes out here is sympathetic, but what is the moral status of what they've lost? And I take very seriously this claim that the extrauterine child is a valid concept. I mean, in a sense, we're all extrauterine children, but, you know, that I remember the secular atheist writer Christopher Hitchens saying this about the term unborn child. And I think this is equally true of extrauterine child. This is not the first time this has come up in a court. So a Virginia court last year, it was actually in one of these divorce cases where a couple had some embryos and they were disputing custody. This Virginia judge ruled that the embryos could constitute goods or chattel under a slavery era law. And I think this is beneath the human dignity of the embryos. And I think that this is more about the parental rights and protections that should come to people who are using IVF. But it's also, it's an issue, unfortunately, that is just not going to go away. This is an industry that, unregulated, is sort of the Wild West of reproductive technologies, as the United States ends up being for a lot of things. We've seen this with transgenderism. We see this with like late-term abortions that don't happen in Europe. European countries and Australia and New Zealand, they're much more careful about how IVF is regulated, in part because they recognize that this should be taken seriously and we should do what we can to minimize the collateral. Obviously, people have a wide range of views about IVF within the pro-life camp. And I think that there can be a bit of a survivorship bias with these things. You know, people think, well, IVF must be a good thing because look, here are all these people who are alive today because of it. And that's true. They are alive today because of it, and they're equal in dignity and value. But then there's all these other embryos that didn't make it, that were frozen indefinitely, that were donated to medical science, which I think is very, very ethically problematic, or destroyed and discarded. As is often the case with these issues, that the focus becomes the choice of the parents, and that's what's happened here, and the nature of their loss and the moral status of what they have lost becomes like a secondary consideration. I was actually thinking of this in relation to an abortion case that happened in Texas recently. It was a woman whose husband, who had been unfaithful, had been poisoning her with abortion drugs against her will. This was a wanted child for her. And he was found out, pled guilty to injury of a child and assault of a pregnant woman. Now, obviously, what he did was utterly grotesque, and it's made all the more grotesque because he was doing it without her knowledge or her consent. But at the same time, it's particularly grotesque because he was injuring a child. It wasn't that he was destroying her property. He did something that crossed a moral line. And I think these conversations are going to keep happening. The IVF industry in the United States is out of control. It is the Wild West. America is also a morally serious country and takes seriously moral questions. And so I think, I think I agree with the Alabama decision. I think extrauterine child is a valid concept in reference to embryos, and it will be interesting to see where this goes.
So, Michael, the other side of that is that this ruling had the instant effect of compelling some IVF providers, including the University of Alabama at Birmingham Health System, to pause in vitro treatments instantly. So sometimes when we get, for example, abortion rulings, they can prompt abortion providers to perform theatrical contortions to illustrate the injustice of this ruling or that don't actually comport with the corners of the particular ruling. But this isn't that. IVF is an expensive process. It involves real investments from parents and grueling physical therapies. So these would be parents who are being treated at the University of Alabama system have to be crushed. And Democrats are obviously gleeful at the opportunity to showcase what they see as evidence of the pro-life movement's desire to impose impediments on access to abortion at all stages of the pregnancy, including now extrauterine. Do Democrats benefit from this in ways that the pro-life community, even if it's a moral victory, a political victory, a political setback for them in the long run?
I have a feeling that this has some benefit for Democrats politically. It's hard to say how much. I mean, obviously, you know, these stories are heavily amplified by the news and news media. You know, the number of people who pursue IVF is still relatively small. I mean, it's like 1%, which is not statistically insignificant, but it is small. It's a growing number. Lots of people don't know what Maddie just said about the lack of regulation in this industry. I mean, the United States and Denmark are these outlier countries for not having stronger regulations about, you know, all sorts of things to do with IVF and consanguinity and you know, number of sperm donations one person can make, etc. You know, where, you know, suddenly you'll find these cases in the United States where you'll find out one sperm donor is the father of, you know, 300 or more living children. And so you have this bizarre risk of consanguineous unions possible between 299 half siblings if they're living in the same region of the country. So those are all these problems that are totally obscure to most Americans. But what isn't obscure is the news media saying, here's a sympathetic couple, older couple who wants to conceive, who wants to form a family, and they're being prevented from doing so, or they're being constrained in a way that seems morally abstemious, and we don't explain the moral thinking behind the restriction. So it's also a sign that, like, a lot of religious conservatives also live in their own bubble and don't actually explain, haven't actually made their thinking plain and common enough to understand to the rest of the country when we're debating these issues. So I think it helps Democrats, but just a little. I mean, this is still a very minority issue, and I don't think the terms are very well understood or commonly understood, except by those who are in some way involved in the process, which is very few.
So, Charlie, both Madeline and Michael outlined what is before Republicans here, which is a campaign of education, and they don't seem inclined to do that. They got very squishy real quick. Right away, Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway shared polling with Politico that found that 86% of the public supports IVF, including 78% of those who identify as pro-life and 83% of self-described evangelicals. House Republicans are running away from the ruling. Pennsylvania Senate candidate Dave McCormick today said IVF is a, quote, ray of hope, and, quote, I oppose any effort to restrict it. Which is not the design of this ruling, but early indications are that it will be the practical effect of it. And yet, when Nikki Haley was confronted with the news out of Alabama, she welcomed it. And it would seem on its face to conflict with the careful needle threading that she was doing on the issue of abortion early in this primary race, although it's obviously not the same thing, but nevertheless, it's going to require on her part some explanation. And explanation is not something that candidates like to do. It puts them on the back foot. But it strikes me as confirmation of something I've thought for a while, which is that the logic of internecine competition within the GOP on the issue of appealing to pro-life voters will lead to politically risky stances on abortion. The logic will compel Republicans to gravitate towards something like a federal ban, 6 to 15 weeks, who knows, because that's where the center of gravity on the Republican Party is.
All right, well, let me take this in stages. I'll start with the last thing you said. It's entirely possible that the internecine warfare that we are seeing will lead the Republicans to take controversial positions. Perhaps this is one of them. You mention a federal ban on abortion, 14 to 16 weeks. The polling on that's really good for Republicans. Whether it would be after the debate had been twisted, I don't know. I, as our listeners know, don't believe that the federal government has an enumerated power that allows it to regulate abortion either way. I don't think that Congress can ban abortion, but the public doesn't seem to care about that. So I'm not entirely convinced that that position, which I think is going to be Donald Trump's position, for what it's worth, will be unpopular. On the question of this IVF ruling, I want to separate out the law from the two questions we've discussed thus far, which are political and moral. This decision was made by a court. That court was obliged to follow the statute that it was considering. That statute seems to me to mandate this ruling. It's not just the majority opinion that concludes that human embryos are included under the statute's umbrella. So did the dissent. And that's not because of Dobbs. That was the case prior to Dobbs. Now, one can argue about whether that should be the case. But if it is the case, that is to say, if the majority is right in its reasoning and the dissent is right in its concession, then Alabama must change its law before the court could come to a different decision. Whether Alabama will, I don't know. Smart politics in response to that would be to say Alabama can pass and uphold whatever laws that it wants, but whichever state the speaker is in doesn't have to, or if the person is running for president, this is not a federal matter. Dave McCormick is running for the Senate in Pennsylvania. As such, he has two responsibilities. One is to the people of Pennsylvania, not Alabama, and the other is to every American, because as a senator, he would be making federal law. I don't think that it is too difficult to square that circle as a party. If the Trump campaign says, we're not in favor of changing the law around IVF federally, and the senators in states other than Alabama say, we're not in favor of changing the law either at the state level or federally, then they can thread that needle. Whether they are able to do so is a separate question. I do accept that this is difficult for Republicans because this matter is reported widely in a way that is damaging for them. But I would rather, if this were the choice, I would rather deal with the political consequences of the court upholding the law than I would see our courts refuse to uphold the law out of fear that some knock-on consequence somewhere will be bad for some politicians somewhere. And those are, I'm afraid, the choices. On the moral question, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I don't have a view on IVF because I've never really thought about it. I intend to think about it now that this is in the news. But unlike Michael and Maddie, there's no religious aspect to this for me. So I would need to sit down and really think about what's involved.
Well, if Democrats have their way, they're going to force it on you. They clearly are inclined to make this an issue. But it's tricky, as we've discussed. So exit question for everybody, starting with you, Madeline. The IVF ruling will be a major campaign theme for Democrats heading into November.
I think it's going to be part of their Republicans are attacking reproductive rights package. They've done that already with contraception. They will doubtless do it with this as well. I still think, for the reason Michael said, that this is, you know, somewhat a minority issue. I think abortion is the big thing that moves the needle. But this doesn't help Republicans politically. We just have to acknowledge that. But it is, in my view, a sort of moral victory, at least for the state of Alabama.
Michael.
Yeah, it'll be, as Maddie says, it'll be incorporated into a more major theme of reproductive rights and freedoms that Democrats have been very successful campaigning on in the last two cycles. And, it's just a minor part of it.
Charlie.
I think that Michael is right, it will get folded into abortion. I think it's much easier for Republicans to deal with if those Republicans don't want to make any changes in the area of IVF, though. The problem Republicans have, and I say problem politically, is that they do want to restrict abortion, and I think rightly so. So when the Democrats say to Republican candidates, well, you want to restrict abortion, the answer has to be, yes, I do. But in the case of, say, Donald Trump, who seems all but guaranteed now to be the Republican candidate, or of, say, a Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania, they can very clearly say, I am not interested in changing the law in this area, and we're not talking about Alabama. Whether they will be able to do that, I don't know. But this one should be much easier to dispense with, if that is indeed their view, than the abortion question, because the abortion question is something that is being fought over nationally, hammer and tongs.
Yeah, I can kind of see that. I can see an effort on the part of Democrats to attempt to make this part of their argument, but it is so ancillary to it that railing against the social compact that prevails in Alabama will end up being more of a digression than an argument against Republicans' outlook on abortion, and it will feel to Democrats like they're having to do the explaining rather than the Republicans that they would like to force on their back foot. So I don't expect it to be a major feature of their argument. Let's take a break real quick to hear from our second sponsor of the day, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Our friends at the Competitive Enterprise Institute are back with their new episodes of their breakout series, How the World Works, a podcast hosted by author and political commentator Kevin Williamson. If you're not already listening to the show, each episode, Kevin sits down with a notable guest for candid conversations about the jobs they've had and the role of work in the economy and our social lives. From flipping burgers and tending pigs on a farm to leading special ops missions in far corners of the globe, some of America's best thinkers discuss the jobs they've had that informed their outlook on life and future careers. In a recent episode, Kevin sat down with Jonah Goldberg, both of whom are old friends and colleagues of National Review, for a fascinating conversation about the ins and outs of Jonah's decades-long career in media. So be sure to listen to How the World Works wherever you get your podcasts, or visit cei.org/howtheworldworks. That's cei.org/howtheworldworks. So I wanted to get your guys' take on a recent item via NBC News' Chuck Todd, what I thought was rather fascinating. He threw some cold water on a narrative preferred by Democrats that the GOP is wholly united by Donald Trump and has remade itself in his image. Democrats are aided in that effort by establishmentarian Republicans who have done their best to broadcast their total support for Donald Trump. But Todd observes that on both the ideological level, the big questions of conservatism, the role of government broadly, the Republican Party is disunited, and tactically, they're disunited, as best exemplified by the paralytic GOP House majority. Quote from Todd, a basic rule of politics and sports says that the team that is more internally divided loses more than it wins. And the GOP divides are far more personal than the divides inside the Democratic tent. He cites a variety of examples for this, and up to and including this very bizarre situation in Michigan, where the party is literally at war with itself and is set to hold two competing nominating conventions, which is demonstrative of how state parties are very divided over the what has become an effort to coronate Trump as the Republican Party's nominee for a third consecutive time. So this rang true to me when I read the Trump campaign's reaction to remarks that Ron DeSantis gave in a private call with supporters. In that call, he flatly rejected being Donald Trump's VP nominee. But he also offered some very gentle criticisms of Trump's team in the effort to exculpate Trump for being responsible for them. He said that he didn't blame Trump himself for the attacks on him. He attributed them to his estranged former campaign official, Susie Wiles. There's no love lost between the two of them. And he said that Trump shouldn't pick a VP based on demography, accidents of birth, the kind of signifiers that round out the ticket. They should pick them on merit alone. Gentle stuff. To this, the Trump team summoned all the maximum bombast they possibly could to condemn Ron DeSantis with the vitriol and conviction of a North Korean newsreader. Trump strategist Chris LeCivita, who's also Trump's pick for RNC chief operating officer, wrote the following. Chicken fingers and pudding cups is what you'll be remembered for, you sad little man. Jason Miller resurrected the epithet Rob, which is supposed to be an insult to Ron DeSantis, and he promised Thor's hammer will return. I don't know what that means, but it sounds ominous. And Trump advisor Stephen Chung said, quote, Ron DeSantis should have scurried off into the shadows of obscurity. Now that he's dipped his high heel toes back in the water, he might find out our shovel can dig a lot. I don't know what any of this means, but it demonstrates to me, Michael, that the thrill of the primary is going to be revived over and over and over again, especially as sledding gets tougher and tougher heading closer to November. This is the homecoming game here. We're going to be reliving this moment over and over again. But it's clear that Team Trump does get a charge out of this thing, and they don't really want unity if it means swallowing their pride. So is Chuck Todd right that the GOP is just going to be squabbling internally for the remainder of the year?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, the GOP is in, you know, a difficult transition. I mean, I was at a conference earlier this week in DC where people were still talking about, you know, realignment politics and how realignments come every 40 years or so. And if there was a Reagan realignment that kind of brought coherence to the GOP with its three-legged stool of Cold War hawkery, social conservatism, and economic free marketeerism, you know, that orthodoxy and coalition kind of running out of gas after 40 years would make sense in American political history. But what you would have expected, though, is for the party to suffer a catastrophic, you know, electoral loss, right? Like the way Democrats experienced that in, you know, 1972 or 1984, which brought about, you know, reflection and reform. We haven't experienced that catastrophic electoral loss. Donald Trump's loss in 2020 was very significant, but he actually left the House party in better shape than it had been in 2006 or 2008. I think, you know, that is one dynamic. The other is that, you know, Donald Trump splits the party in two ways. Normally a candidate splits a party ideologically, right? That's normally the effect a divisive campaign within a party has, is that it creates ideological groups and coalitions. Trump does that to some degree, right? Between more populist-leaning conservatives and more establishmentarian conservatives or traditional conservatives. But Trump divides people because there are also a huge number of people who just object to him on the character issues and on his self-presentation, on his crudity. And so he divides us in temperamental ways that are hard to describe. I think the Republican Party is going to remain divided until we find a popular leader. I mean, Charlie and I are famous. I went down to DC this week and people said, I love when Charlie and you disagree on the editors. You know, it's really productive. It really helps me think through things. And I love that too. And yet Charlie and I both would have been thrilled for Ron DeSantis to be the nominee of the party, because we both look to him as someone who could put together a winning, successful, and worthwhile governing coalition that can succeed in doing things both of us like. And that's what you get when you get a politician who can, in his races, put together, you know, a 20-point win. That's not something Donald Trump can do nationally, and we don't have a figure in the party that can do that nationally. Until then, we'll be searching for unity.
So, Charlie, I guess we shouldn't ignore the countersigns as we hear reports now from the Trump campaign, or at least the people speaking for the former president, that he plans to subordinate his feud with, for example, Larry Hogan, former Maryland governor, for the good of Republican chances in Maryland as he's running for U.S. Senate. Do you think he can keep that up for 2 seconds once Hogan responds to some reporter's question about the latest Trump scandal in the negative? I certainly don't.
I can be heard on the first few hundred episodes of this podcast saying, if only Trump could. And I can be heard on the 300 or so we've done subsequently saying Trump cannot. Because this isn't a matter of calculation. People who are particularly scared of Donald Trump and his potential actions often make him seem like a mastermind. Here's what they're planning. What he meant here was, look at how they're laying the groundwork. Not really. That isn't to say Trump isn't a problem or hasn't done some terrible things, but he is unbelievably capricious. He's childlike. He lashes out. So no, I don't think that he can keep it going. What I do think is that he has assembled a good team around him that may manage to sand off some of those edges or at least channel his whirlwind personality in ways that are more productive. I am as surprised by this as anyone. But I keep speaking to people who know a great deal about practical politics, the sort of area in which I have no expertise whatsoever. And they keep telling me that Trump's election team, both within the primaries and presumably soon in the general, is elite. That's going to help. It's certainly a surprise to me because I had been informed that he would not be able to find anyone to work for him. So, yes and no, I suppose. But the candidate is the candidate, and he's always going to cost himself votes and get nothing in return. And this is, all else aside, this is the most frustrating thing about him from an electoral perspective. I'm not voting for him anyway. But from an electoral perspective, you look at the guy and you think, you're not doing that and dealing with the consequences. You're doing that for no reason and you'll have to pay the consequences. And that's the odd thing about him. So yeah, he will go after a Senate candidate here or a representative there. He will lash out at people that he needs. The La Civita quote you mentioned was a good example of that. What did he get out of that? What did he get out of that with DeSantis?
All I mean, that didn't come from Trump. That came from the people around him.
I know. I'm saying. He will do that. They will do that. But he's, I don't know. He's incapable of it. And it's really going to come down to whether or not the country is so annoyed with Joe Biden or worried about Joe Biden's age that it says it doesn't mind.
So, Madeline, this might come as a shock to everyone. But right now, as we speak, CPAC is happening. To call it a low-key affair is an understatement. There's very little attention being paid to this year's events, and the pictures that I've seen from the floor make it appear rather abandoned. I don't know if that's an angling issue or whether that's a real assessment from the people who are there, but it does seem like this is less of an affair than it had been in previous years, and why wouldn't it be? There's no room on the agenda for the also-ran presidential aspirants who would typically expose themselves to a CPAC audience, no ideological debates over the future direction of the conservative movement or the country it hopes to lead. It's become an exercise in Trump cheerleading, with a lot of hostility directed toward the holdouts, foremost among them being Nikki Haley, and a ton of praise for people who are not at all conservative. Folks like former Democratic Rep. Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, and El Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele, who, along with his allies, summarily reinterpreted the Constitution to stay in power. Already, you can see the appeal. As entertainment, it makes sense that CPAC would be sleepy, because there's no friction, there's no desire for tension. It's a display of false unity, and a shallow one at that, insofar as there are very few participants in the exercise. There's always a risk of overanalyzing this thing, but let's risk it. What does this tell you about the conservative movement and the Republican Party?
Well, it's sort of a microcosm of the divisions and dysfunction you were just talking about. I mean, you're right. CPAC used to be a forum for a wide range of conservatives to debate and hash out their differences. And they were united by the idea that they had a common enemy. And, you know, very much like the modern Democratic Party, I think, as much as they have their ideological divisions, they're able to say things like, we're on the same team. I mean, AOC said that after the special elections in New York. She said, no, I have my differences with Tom Suozzi, but we're on the same team. That just is not where the GOP is. So naturally, CPAC's shrunk. It's very MAGA. The outsized media interest has sort of dwindled somewhat. You had Matt Schlapp, the chairman of the American Conservative Union, begin with this completely absurd overstatement that Trump is this unique American who's being persecuted, who's being tortured, who is a victim of the democratic policies based on the world's worst dictators, whether it be Putin, whether it be Xi. And when you consider like recent news about Navalny or, you know, what's happening with the Uyghurs, this is just like, I mean, I'm quick to point out that a lot of the attacks of Trump have been misuse or abuse of power, and they're certainly partisan, but this is, come on, he's not being tortured. It's a ridiculous overstatement. And as you say, you know, there's a temptation from the outside to kind of think of this as being irrelevant. I got a kick out the fact that they had Liz Truss there, the former Prime Minister of Britain, if you can remember. She was very short-lived, or short-lived, as Jane Ordling would say. And she has this, like, reputation for political shape-shifting and opportunism, so it's kind of hilarious to see.
And she was doing her best Trump impression.
She was.
About her own experience being ejected from Tory leadership.
Yes, no, exactly. She had her own persecution narrative. I mean, a big part of that is that she's trying to sell her book. She's got a book coming out. I mean, why not try sell it over the Atlantic? But yeah, it's very tempting from the outside to say, oh, this is irrelevant. What a MAGA circus. What a carnival. But the danger with that is, depressingly, this is not so much irrelevant as representative. This is the future of the Republican Party. This is its dominant forces. And you can tell who is winning just by who is absent from the stage.
Well, can I just jump in real quick? I have a slightly different take on CPAC. I think both the combination of the outlandishness and then what you observed, Noah, and some of the photographic evidence, which was a marked drop in attendance and interest. This reminds me a lot of the Tea Party groups that grew up about a decade ago. Some of them as, you know, almost an alternative to what was then CPAC. And they would flourish for 1 or 2 years. You know, they'd hold a giant conference in, you know, say Nashville and get Sarah Palin to talk. They would overcharge all the attendees, and then none of them would come back for the second year because they'd either lost interest or they'd felt fleeced, or they themselves thought that they're, you know, this is kind of like a lot of show without substance. So, you know, I wonder if it's just if we're watching this as like a flame out rather than an enduring, block of the party that's going to be immovable in the future. Just throwing it out there. I'm laying my marker down.
Yeah, it's worthwhile. We're running a little long, but I want to get a quick exit question in here because we're talking about, you know, disunity in the party. We can't not talk about Nikki Haley, who's the foremost expression of it, although right now no evidence that she's at all a threat to Donald Trump's ascension to lead the Republican Party. But if Donald Trump is an incumbent, he's a weak one. His showing in Iowa and New Hampshire demonstrates it. And we have another primary this weekend. Haley's expected to lose it, but her polling has been improving relative to Donald John Trump's in South Carolina, where he kind of plateaued. And if you look at the Real Clear Politics average Nikki Haley's climbing quite a bit. The momentum is on her side, and Donald Trump's is kind of declining slightly. Nevertheless, it's still a 60-30 proposition, roughly. Where do you guys think she ends up on Saturday? You don't have to give me a number if you don't want to, but will it approach a threshold at which point there would be a shakeup in the media narrative, which is that this thing's been over for a while? Michael.
I think she'll be at, I think she'll actually get over 30. I think Donald Trump's forces.
That would be roughly where she's pulling right now, around 35.
Yeah, I think she'll be a little over 30. And I think it's partly because her supporters are very passionate. Donald Trump's supporters are very secure in the idea that he's the presumptive nominee. So her supporters have all the reason to turn out in force. And I actually think it will slightly change the narration, which is, it's been that, oh, it's Donald Trump's party, it's Donald Trump's party. I think what we're going to come to is the truth that's been lurking, I think, in all the polls going back 2 years, which is it's Donald Trump's party, but it's weak. It's a weak party, and he is weakly holding it together. He does have a very firm, committed base, but he doesn't dominate the party the way some previous nominees did.
Charlie, where does Nikki Haley end up on Saturday night?
If she doesn't get much over 30%, it's catastrophic for her. It's her own state. And I think she'll have to drop out. I think she's going to get maybe 35%, and I think it's going to be catastrophic, and I think she's going to have to drop out.
Fair enough. Madeline?
Sadly, I agree with Charlie.
I'm going to put myself out on the limb here a little bit, and I think she approaches 40%. Maybe not quite cresting it, but approaching it 37, 38 in ways that outperform her polling. The momentum is on her side. It's a weird Saturday contest. It's an open primary. There's much more interest in her campaign given the state of Donald Trump's inevitable ascension to lead the party. So I think she gets close to 40%. I don't think she crests it. But there will be a bit of a story over the weekend about how, oh, this is kind of a shakeup, and then by Monday we forget about it. So we'll see. Let's take a minute to do a quick plug for NR Plus. It is your way around our metered paywall. You know what you're doing. You're opening incognito windows. You're stealing your mom's password. It's unnecessary. It's a lot of work. You don't have to do it. If you just pay a small amount, you'll get access to the whole suite of National Review offerings, from the magazine to the lively debate that occurs on the corner to our articles and our editorials. It's an important way to support our journalism and National Review's mission. And also, please consider giving us a glowing review on iTunes. It's good for us. It's good for the show. It helps everybody else find the show. If you like it, share. Let's move on to some lighter business. Charlie, you have been watching the acclaimed actor Stanley Tucci not acting,
eating, drinking, walking around in Italy against beautiful backdrops with beautiful food, beautiful people who speak that beautiful language. It is a beautiful show. I think it aired on CNN a while back. I am enjoying it enormously. It's called Searching for Italy with Stanley Tucci. I don't know where you can find it, to be honest with you, because I was sent it on a DVD by my parents from England, having booked a trip to Italy, which we took last May.
I think
if you can find it, do find it. Where is it, Michael?
Max and Hulu, I think.
Max and Hulu. There you go.
CNN's program.
Yeah, I have the DVDs.
Cool. Madeline, you are reading a novel by an author I will decline to pronounce. It's called The Painted Veil. I can pronounce that part.
Yes. I think it's by W. Somerset Maugham, but it maybe is. It's Maugham. it's a great, great novel. I just finished it. And it's a sad story of a marriage in trouble. It's set in the 1920s. It's a British couple who go to China, a fictional colony in China, and the wife's unfaithful, and then the husband drags them both into the middle of a cholera epidemic, And the I won't ruin it because maybe our listeners might want to read it, but it has a very different ending in the novel than it does in the movie. And it's so that it's actually been made into like three movies, but the most recent one came out in 2006, has Naomi Watts, Edward Norton. And I actually, this is a rare occasion where I think I prefer the movie. Now, the novel's still great, but I think I prefer the movie because it's less depressing. So anyway, there's some recommendations if people want to go read a depressing novel or watch a slightly less depressing movie.
Sounds fun in a sort of way. Michael, you got the kids around you.
Yeah, they've been on winter break this week while we've been working from home, and it's just been a joy to give them a break from school and kind of let them indulge. I think there's kind of a pressure, especially in New York, that all kids are like organization kids now, and you know, constantly doing activities or enriching things, and it's actually been fun to give them almost like a traditional summer break in the middle of winter, where they just play around the house and entertain themselves and share with us the little funny jokes and memes they get from classmates.
I want to take this opportunity to shamelessly plug a new show that I'm doing. It's called Issues with Noah Rothman. Last week I was blessed to have my colleagues Michael and Dominic Pino join me for a debate on the controversy around providing arms and support to Ukraine. This week I had the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Jonathan Schanzer, and Mediaite's Isaac Shore, a National Review alum, on to debate the Israel-Hamas war and what the real threat is to Joe Biden's bottom line in November from the rabble of anti-Israel activists. If you too want to have issues with Noah Rothman, you can find it on YouTube or X at Two Way TV app. That's the number 2 Way TV app, APP. Guys, let's do some editor's picks real quick before we get out of here. Madeline, what's your pick?
I just encourage people to follow the work of Caroline Downey. I think she's a real asset to National Review in multiple ways. She's a great reporter, but she's also a great broadcaster. And she works very hard, and I think she deserves a lot of credit for it.
100% agree. You should catch her videos and her her podcasts, as well as her writing. I concur. Michael?
Mine is a kind of double pick. It's Armand White, and it's two pieces written in the past couple weeks. The first was The Curse of the Princess Bride, and the second was Can Conservative Filmgoers Win the Culture War? The first was his takedown of The Princess Bride, one of the most beloved films. You know,
totally wrong.
Armin's slaying of sacred cows is just the bravest and most, heedless I've ever seen. And I love it. I love that he cultivates a totally distinctive critical voice and taste. I think he's pursuing criticism in a very serious way that pulls against the poptimism of the rest of the culture. And he always gives me something to think about, especially when he is most disagreeable. I love him.
Charlie, what's your pick?
Well, as you know, I'm a big Jim Garrity fan, and he has a post this morning. Why does the president need note cards to talk to donors? Now, this is an excellent post, but I must quibble with the opening, which is, no, it's not the biggest deal in the world to hear that President Biden now uses note cards when giving remarks and answering questions at his closed-door, high-dollar campaign fundraisers. I actually think it is. I think it is the biggest deal. Or at least it is a big deal. I don't know why people keep saying, but her emails. Oh, but his age. If he cannot function without note cards, then he can't be president. Anyway, Jim and I seem to agree on the rest of it, because he goes through and explains exactly why it is, in fact, a big deal, which it is. And the best part about this post is it gives all sorts of examples. I have a sort of general impression of Biden as being out of it and unable to answer questions and giving wrong answers and telling lies and mixing people up. But Jim has some choice examples of this in this post that you should read and then conclude that I'm right. And in fact, it is the biggest deal.
I'm going to cite Jeff Blair's Yale University decides it needs better students again. Yale is joining in a movement to reinstate standardized testing as a requirement for evaluation and admission. And they note that the effort to do away with standardized testing actually disadvantaged minority applicants in poorer schools, which is exactly what the objection was in the first place from the supposed troglodytic right-wing racists. Jeff writes, no, it's because a test-free policy simply made the resulting class not only dumber, but whiter as well. Yale is returning to testing requirements not only in the hopes of amenitizing the meritocracy so much as making sure it still remains properly racially calibrated. Indeed. That's going to do it for us. You have been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of the show without express written permission of National Review magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Madeline. Thank you, Michael. And thank you to the absent Rich Lowry. And thank you to our advertisers, Donors Trust, and the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors, and we'll see you next time.